What is it that some entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, animal activists, and environmentalists all have in common? They share a belief in a future where meat alternatives can tackle the environmental impacts and animal suffering caused by industrial animal agriculture.
So the prediction I'm willing to make for 2050 is that it will no longer be a debatable proposition anywhere on planet Earth that our future will be entirely clean meat.
My extreme vision is I would like to see a world where we actually don't need to farm animals for food.
In this futuristic vision of replacing livestock with plant-based substitutes and cultivating meat in labs from animal cells, are we living in a utopia or a dystopia? Welcome to the Alternative Meat episode of the Meet the Four Futures podcast, presented by Table. I'm Matthew Kessler, your guide for the series, that dives into the science, the vision, and the pathway for four different futures: efficient meat, less meat, no meat, and alternative meat.
We want to create a 21st century kind of meat industry where we continue eating all of the meat that humanity wants, but without the need to cause so much harm to the planet and to animals.
Can this future replace the traditional beef burger on most Western plates? And can it meet the increasing demand for meat as the world's population grows?
Our vision is one that stewards the welfare of farmers, that provides nourishment for millions, that creates economic growth across the global South.
Here we speak with scientists, investors, and CEOs who are committed to developing meat alternatives that closely replicate the taste and texture of animal meat, without the slaughter and welfare concerns associated with traditional animal-sourced foods. And while we're putting forward the best arguments for this future, we'll also dig into the evidence that might make you a little skeptical of what it's promising. If you haven't listened to the previous episodes of this series, you can find them in your podcast feed to hear the whole story. And we want to hear what surprised or challenged you while listening. You can record yourself in a quiet room and send the audio to podcast@tabledebates.org, and your voice might be featured in a future episode. Part 1. The Why.
When most people eat meat today, they're not sitting around thinking, "Ah, I'm so glad an animal was tormented and slaughtered for this meat."
Paul Shapiro, author of Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World, began thinking about animal welfare issues when watching television as a child.
If you go back and watch Star Trek, they don't make meat from animal slaughter on there. They have replicators that just make meat.
We no longer enslave animals for food purposes.
But we have seen humans eat meat.
You've seen something as fresh and tasty as meat, but inorganically materialized out of patterns used by our transporters.
And it's not just Star Trek. This has been in science fiction for a very long time. The question is, can we turn science fiction into science fact? Can we actually produce meat experiences that can be made inside of a fermenter or a cultivator rather than inside of an animal's body?
Sickening. Barbaric.
You've probably heard of Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, and maybe even tried one of the many plant and fungi-based meat substitutes in the last decade, or possibly long before that, since this isn't actually a new idea.
The first time there was any recipe for creating a meat experience without animals goes back to more than 1,000 years ago in China, where there's a recipe for a mock lamb dish that relied on soybeans and on wheat gluten. You fast forward to, let's say, like the 1980s, and all of a sudden you started having companies like Tofurky and Lightlife, which started to create foods that were kind of meat-like, but they wouldn't fool a carnivore, but they were really designed for vegetarians.
In the last decade, there's been an explosion of companies and private investment into alternative meats. And part of that reason is companies are starting to target meat eaters with their products.
We're going to try to create experiences that are comparable to meat, so much so that meat lovers will want it, not just vegetarians.
I should point out here that Paul Shapiro is now the CEO of one of these companies, the Better Meat Co., operating out of Sacramento, California. They aren't using plants as a base for their product, nor are they using animal cells.
We run fungi fermentations in order to create meat experiences that we believe are more economical and more effective at mimicking animal meat than the other two kingdoms are capable of doing today.
On the wall of the Better Meat Co.'s facility, looming above their large bioreactors, is a 40-foot mural that was envisioned by Paul's colleague.
Her name is Prachi Jha, and she envisioned a transition of the way that humanity has procured meat over the last few thousand years. So it's six panels, and the first panel is of a First Nations person hunting a bison. And that, of course, is how humanity used to get meat, by hunting and gathering, or hunting in this case. Of course, those people and the bison were removed by cowboys and cattle.
So the next panel is set around 200 years ago in the North American plains, showing the near extermination of the bison and the cultures that sustained it. This is the beginning of the scaling up of beef production, where train tracks are being built across the continent to help transport beef to people living far away from where the animals are raised.
Then you move to the 1950s, where you had the inception of factory farming. So animals start to be confined, but they're not yet in total confinement. Then you fast forward to the present, in the year 2022, where nearly all farm animals are confined permanently indoors, wing to wing, inside of windowless warehouses where they're living in their own feces. These animals are genetically selected to grow so big, so fast, that many of them can't even take more than a few steps prior to collapsing underneath their own unnatural bulk.
Paul Shapiro describes the last two panels, which paint his company's vision of a new meat future.
Which are a fermentation-fueled future, where we can continue serving humanity all of the meat that it wants to eat, except without the need to raise animals. And so in these final two panels, you see a fermenter producing all of this meat, and you see a group of people standing in the wild where the bison are back on the land, the turkeys are back on the land, and we're not harming animals to procure meat anymore.
So this is what the Better Meat Co. is setting out to create.
Not necessarily a path to the way that we did things in the past as a species, but we want to create a 21st century kind of meat industry where we continue eating all of the meat that humanity wants, but without the need to cause so much harm to the planet and to animals. And that's what we're trying to do here by using fermentation to turn microbes into meat.
A lot of people are attracted to Paul Shapiro's vision, where animal suffering is greatly reduced, and land that was used for animal agriculture is transitioned back into wildlands and forests for wild animals to thrive. One of Better Meat Co.'s supporters is Steve Jurvetson, an early-stage venture capitalist whose investment portfolio includes SpaceX, Tesla, Skype, and Upside Foods.
Look out 500 years. There's no doubt that we won't slaughter animals for meat. There's no doubt that we will not burn gasoline for cars. And there's no doubt that we'll be colonizing other worlds. This is our inevitable future.
As we talked about in the Efficient Meat episode, we've made incredible advancements in animal agriculture over the last 50 to 60 years. But Steve Jurvetson sees the potential of building a new paradigm around the production and consumption of meat.
Imagine you could somehow magically cause no suffering on the part of the animals. You still have the land use, the greenhouse gases, all the other problems where you're facing a 10x efficiency disadvantage versus cellular agriculture. Why would you do that?
For Steve Jurvetson, this isn't only an environmental fix. It's also a wider moral question.
It just seems so obvious to me that once we have an alternative to meat manufacturing that will actually cast an eye to how we do it today in a way that we just psychologically can't. The cognitive dissonance is too high, right? Meat eaters don't want to visit slaughterhouses, even if we could. I could tell that I was blinded. My own psychology wouldn't let me truly dwell on animal suffering, and that my future self would once I had a credible alternative.
Venture capitalist Steve Jurvetson wonders why we would continue to raise animals for slaughter when alternatives now exist. So we've been talking about meat alternatives, something that could replace meat by imitating its look, its taste, and its texture. but there are lots of alternatives out there. Some are plant-based, or as the Better Meat Co. uses, ones based on fungi. And there's cellular agriculture, where you take cell cultures from animal products, like meat, milk, or eggs, and then grow them in a lab. We now visit Canada and speak to a real pioneer in this field. She's such a pioneer that back in 2015, she actually coined the term cellular agriculture.
I think what moved me the most was seeing the environmental impact of animal agriculture on the world.
And can you introduce yourself?
My name is Isha Datar. I'm executive director of New Harvest.
New Harvest is a research institute dedicated to advancing the science of cultured meat. They're the longest running nonprofit in the field, starting in 2004.
Where I grew up here in Edmonton, you know, we're a very fossil fuels oriented place. And to see that animal agriculture had such a huge outsized effect on our environment in all these different ways was quite shocking to me, because I really did think farms were, you know, rolling pastures, some kind of like cyclical relationship with the earth. And really, it's not like that.
After learning about animal agriculture's impact on the climate, Isha Datar's first thought was that everyone could just shift their diets.
First, I thought we're going to all become vegetarian. Then I realized that has been a message for literally thousands of years.
We're going to explore what a plant-based future could look like in a few weeks. But when she learned about cultivating meat in labs,
to hear that we could grow meat from cells made me feel like, oh my gosh, this is like such an obvious next step for humanity and a real win-win-win when you think about not just reducing environmental impact, but also animals need not suffer anymore for food. And what would that mean in terms of like an ethical and moral transition for humanity as well?
And how have your motivations changed in the last decade?
I think what drives me towards it today is still that, although now I'm a lot more aware that achieving that environmental impact is going to require a lot of scale, a lot of tech development, and so on. I think what drives me towards that is that I still think that CellAg has the greatest capacity to disrupt animal agriculture.
So why does Isha Datar think animal agriculture needs disrupting?
Not only is animal agriculture like one of the biggest contributors to climate change, especially through methane emissions, it is also one of the most prone to climate change. You know, a changing climate means that animals are not in optimal environments anymore. And so we see a lot of effects in terms of tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of cattle or pigs being wiped out due to just some kind of rogue storm or snow event or any other kind of climate event.
Isha is concerned about how animal agriculture has been scaled into these high-density environments, where lots of animals are crowded into a small building or piece of land. But besides the animal welfare argument, she's also concerned about diseases.
So we have these epidemic viruses popping up all the time. Every year, you hear at least one gigantic outbreak where millions of animals need to be culled. And, you know, very quietly in the background, we've been in the midst of an African swine fever amongst pigs that has killed at least a quarter of the pigs in the world.
It's true that in 2019, there were about 440 million fewer domesticated pigs than in previous years. China is responsible for half of the world's production, and they culled half of their pigs. It's not 100% clear that it's all attributed to African swine fever, but it definitely played a role.
We don't really hear about it in the media, but that is an enormous food security risk. That is an enormous public health risk. It's almost become so big that it will fail due to the way that it has become big.
The search for meat alternatives is, of course, a global issue. A global issue driven by the planet's population growth. Imagine, back in the year 1800, there wasn't even 1 billion people on planet Earth. 100 years ago, there were 2 billion. When I was born, we recently passed 5 billion. And last year, 8 billion. How big a role will meat alternatives play in feeding this future? Part 2, Meeting the Global Demand with Meat Alternatives. As incomes and populations rise across the global south, the trends are showing an increased demand for meat. Here we speak with people building out an alternative meat future in Asia, the continent with the largest population, and Africa, the continent with the fastest growing population.
Africa is such a key market.
Hakeem Jimo, CEO of Veggie Victory, the first plant-based food tech company operating in Nigeria.
I'm all in for everything that helps, you know, getting animals out of the food chains.
Africans consume a lot less meat per capita than Europeans or Americans, and that's not the only thing that's different.
I always talk about leapfrogging. We have seen it in other technologies. Like, we never went for, didn't have the chance to go for landlines, too expensive to have it, you know, or personal computers. We had to go for mobile phones, mobile computers. And there's this concept that if we can also leapfrog the meat before we start eating meat, let's jump that and go into good meat or whatever you want to call it. You know, whether it's from, I hope it's from plant-based. I think it's the most efficient, easiest, quickest. But if it's clean meat or what you call a cultured meat, cell meat, insects, well, still better than cows. Bring it on.
So he is excited. But he's also a little skeptical of meat that's grown from animal cells.
I know it will probably not work in Africa for a long time because it's another premium thing. You know, I know technology will bring prices down, but at the same time, how much time do we have left? Shall we now wait for 10 years now? You know, in 10 years, meat consumption is doubling.
Hakeem Jimo strongly identifies as a vegan. He sees a path forward for a plant-based future, so you'll hear more from him in that episode. We also spoke with the Good Food Institute India. You'll first hear from Managing Director Varun Deshpande.
We do have major challenges in this part of the world relating to undernutrition. Of course, we also have, as the rest of the world does, overnutrition, diabetes, issues like hypertension, obesity, etc.
India has some unique challenges, which includes feeding 1.5 billion people.
But perhaps what's special in this part of the world is undernutrition. Issues like iron deficiency anemia, neural tube defects arising from folic acid deficiencies, these are really, really debilitating issues that they rob our population of their ability to shape their own destiny.
And the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change only make the situation more dire.
Studies from the likes of the International Food Policy Research Institute, from the UN Environmental Program, they're all identifying that climate change is going to result in hundreds of millions more hungry by 2030. COVID-19 is resulting in hundreds of millions more in extreme poverty by 2030. So we have this obligation, we have this responsibility to create food systems that are more nourishing, that are more efficient, and we really don't have time to waste.
Good Food Institute has a shared vision to greet these challenges across all of its global branches, from California to Brussels, Sao Paulo to Tel Aviv, and Singapore to Mumbai.
We're focused on building the alternative protein sector from the ground up. We work across business, science, and policy. And our work in India, as it is across the global south, is actually quite special because it's focused on locating alternative proteins within the context of the developing world.
Alternatives to meat, eggs, and dairy present compelling solutions to address both sustainability as well as food security in the developing world.
Nicole Rock, Senior Innovation Specialist at Good Food Institute India, speaks to why they focus on alternative proteins.
Relying on animals for protein is an inefficient use of the world's resources. Meat requires more energy, water, and land to produce than any other food source. In order to halt a climate catastrophe, we need to immediately cut methane emissions, halt deforestation, prevent agricultural sprawl, and shift consumptions towards plant-forward diets.
Animal consumption is going up around the world, which affects everyone. More farmed animals means more animal feed needs to be grown. And with how interconnected our global supply chains are, Any decision about production, consumption, or distribution in one region has knock-on effects elsewhere. Good Food Institute envisions an alternative to today's global industrial animal production, and Nicole Rock is especially excited about the role that India can play in building an alternative protein sector.
We have the potential to accelerate new product innovation as well as lay down the path towards cost reduction globally, advancing the sector on various dimensions around taste, price, and accessibility, while simultaneously establishing a model for the sector's growth in the developing world.
Nicole says India can be incredibly competitive when it comes to developing meat alternatives, not only on cost, but also by providing a highly skilled workforce.
By leveraging and advancing our inherent expertise in biopharmaceuticals, industrial fermentation, food processing, we see huge potential to build a globally competitive manufacturing supply chain for the sector out of India.
Varun Deshpande, Managing Director of Good Food Institute India, describes a vision for alternative protein that centers the importance of small-scale farmers in the future.
What governments and folks in the private sector are trying to do is to get farmers to do things like step away from the crops that they've been growing for decades, which are perhaps cash crops, perhaps crops that are not as nourishing to the soil, crops like rice, wheat, sugarcane that were prized during the Green Revolution, promoted during the Green Revolution, but perhaps have served their purpose over the last decades, right? And the kinds of crops that they're being asked to move over to are millets, pulses, nitrogen-fixing, highly sustainable crops by comparison. But the issue is farmers are really unable to make this transition unless they're able to then sell those raw materials into lucrative, fast-growing end markets. And that's where smart protein comes in. We're seeing companies in India and all over the world that are producing next-generation ingredients for plant-based meat, egg, dairy foods, that are needing to procure these crops at huge volumes. That could be that lucrative end market for farmers to sell into. I mean, you can't really build a value chain that leads to nowhere.
I would say that Varun Deshpande's vision is a little broader than the ones you typically hear in North America and Europe. Instead of only focusing on replacing livestock with more environmentally friendly alternatives, Varun emphasizes the crucial role of farmers in shaping this future. And even though he's optimistic about this future, he acknowledges it's an uphill battle ahead.
I think unfortunately or fortunately, meat as a part of the diet, the demand for meat, the taste of meat, the juiciness of meat, the aspiration of meat, that's not going away anytime soon. So yeah, I think this is a necessary part of the future. And our hope is that we can establish it as a lucrative industry so that it can grow towards the end of this decade and beyond to truly provide a viable alternative.
Next, we dive into the science behind production. Part 3, the what. So just to be clear, in this alternative meat future, we're exploring how novel foods aim to replace the slaughter, the suffering, the emissions, the land, the water, and other resources used by livestock. Some, like Paul Shapiro of the Better Meat Co., are even exploring new branding for restaurants.
People talk about farm-to-fork dining. I often talk about fermenter-to-fork dining.
There's more than one category of meat alternative. There's plant-based meat substitutes, which use plant ingredients to try to mimic the taste and texture of meat. A second category is protein made from microorganisms, where fungi, algae, or bacteria are grown and multiplied under controlled conditions into a product to also imitate meat. The company Corn, with a QU, has been doing this for decades now. And then there's the new kid on the block, which gets a lot of attention in this space, where animal cells are grown in a lab to end up with meat on your plate. Lots of names have been proposed to call this last group, ranging from cellular meat, lab-grown meat, clean meat, cultivated meat, or cultured meat. It's worth mentioning that any suggestion of meat in the name draws criticism from the livestock industry. Just like the dairy industry challenges the idea that nuts, seeds, or cereals can produce milk. But if you can produce something that's indistinguishable to the eater, or even identical at a molecular level, the question of where you draw the line isn't obvious. And how does it actually work? That depends on the meat alternative. Let's take each one at a time, starting with plant-based meat substitutes.
Let's just take the Beyond Burger, which is, you know, maybe the most well-known of these products. So their hero ingredient is called pea protein.
You may recognize pea protein from reading the ingredient list on the back of a food product, like a plant-based burger. So this process starts with a farmer growing a field of peas.
You take that field of peas, you harvest it, and you mill it into a flour. Now you have a pea flour. But pea flour is not that high in protein. So you basically undergo what's called a fractionation process, where you strip out the fiber, you strip out the fat, and you concentrate it down into a pea protein powder that an athlete might take as a supplement.
So you start with peas, mill it into a pea flour, and then concentrate it into a pea protein powder, in a process that's similar to the traditional way of making tofu. But you don't yet have the texture of animal meat.
So then it's subjected to something that's called extrusion, which is a fancy way of saying lots of heat and lots of pressure. And that changes the structure of the protein to go from being globular to becoming stringy. So plant proteins are typically globular, like a globe, and animal proteins are typically stringy. And so that's why companies like Beyond Meat are so focused on extrusion practices, because they can change peas into something that ultimately has the texture of animal meat.
So that's the heart of making plant-based meat alternatives, though a lot of other processes can be involved, especially when trying to recreate the flavor of meat. Then there's proteins for microorganisms, and we'll focus on one in particular that the company Corn and others use. They use a fungus called Fusarium that has a really fibrous texture that's used to mimic the chewiness in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. To produce it, you take this fungus through a fermentation process and grow it in big tanks in a nutrient-rich soup that includes glucose, nitrogen, and other vitamins and minerals. This growing medium can be made from feed crops, food waste, or agricultural waste. The fungus grows in size by eating up all these nutrients and converting them into protein called mycoprotein. This is then harvested, purified, and processed into different cuts of meat that we are familiar with, like fillets, nuggets, or minced meat. So that's plant-based substitutes and mycoprotein. And now moving on to cultured meat. Isha Datar, who we heard from earlier, explains how you begin with sampling cells from animals and end up with something meat-like on your plate, using a surprising analogy.
The process of culturing meat is It comes to mind to me like almost like a nested drop-down menu, because like you can talk about it in a simple way, and then like each one of those ways could be multiple different approaches. So just keep that in mind.
So at the top of the drop-down menu, you've got a few options.
You get a cell from an animal, and the drop-down list there is, it could be a biopsy from a living animal. It could be a sample of tissue from an animal that was slaughtered. It could be from an egg. That cell could come from one of many different types of sources.
Depending on where that cell comes from, you then choose your medium to grow it on.
The medium is what provides all the nutrients that those cells need to grow and divide. There's kind of two different stages. There's the growing in number. So first you want the cells to multiply. And then after a certain number of multiplications, you want that those cells to grow by maturing into muscle fibers.
Isha points out another possible drop-down. You can mature these cells into muscle fibers by growing them on different types of scaffold.
And the scaffold is kind of like the surface that the cells like to adhere on. The scaffold sometimes like signals that the cells need to stretch or can provide some kind of stretchiness.
The scaffold is also what helps give the cells a certain shape.
And then all of that growth would take place in a bioreactor. And so the bioreactor is more or less like just a giant stainless steel tank that provides everything that those cells need in terms of like oxygenation and carbon dioxide and kind of waste products being removed and some movement so that the cells are all kind of bathed in media and nutrients are being brought to them evenly.
So after you grow these cells, you can mature them into something like edible tissue or make a burger-like texture.
Or you might see them onto the scaffold, as I mentioned, and create something more like this kind of sashimi or fish or like more structured stuff. So there's a lot of flexibility, but it kind of comes down to those four main elements: cells, medium, scaffold, and bioreactor.
Most of the market is now made up of plant-based meat substitutes and mycoproteins to imitate meat. People in this field expect animal cell-cultured meat to make a big splash in the next few years and decades, though there are a few important unanswered questions. How much will it cost? Can we trust that it will be safe for us to eat? Will it pass a blind taste test? And does it really have such a low environmental impact? Part 4. What do we know and what don't we know? Alternative meat technologies sound great, and it's easy to get swept away in their big claims and promises. In fact, of all the four futures, they are the most charismatic of the bunch, having had more practice pitching their visions to find funding. But some people against, or at least hesitant, about these technologies wonder if these alternatives are really as good as they're claiming to be. And since some products, like the ones that are culturing meat from animal cells, are barely on the market at all, it's a little hard to say. We talked to some researchers who have begun to explore some key questions, like, what does the science say? Is the product healthy? Is it more ethical? Is it actually better for the environment?
Nearly every environmental impact we looked at followed a pretty similar pattern.
Rachel Santo, researcher at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, co-authored a paper in 2020 that looked at plant-based and cell-based meat substitutes from a public health and food systems perspective.
With few exceptions, conventionally farmed beef has the highest environmental impacts among all foods. So if you're using that as your comparison point, almost any alternative will look sustainable.
Rachel and her colleagues found that plant and cell-based meat substitutes had lower emissions than meat from animals. But there is some variation, which depends on the individual studies they looked at, and it depends on the animal.
Not all meats are the same, and that really means that substituting these meats means that the substitutions aren't necessarily the same. In some cases, it's slightly misleading, I think, to be advertising the potential benefits of a meat alternative, whether plant-based or cell-based, and always using beef as the reference value, because they're always going to look better.
We'll link to the study so you can check it out yourself. But here are some summarized findings when comparing the environmental impact of animal agriculture to these alternatives. In general, plant-based substitutes and mycoprotein showed lower land and water use and lower greenhouse gas emissions compared to the animal products they imitate. Some plant-based meats had similar climate impacts to poultry and eggs, which emit less greenhouse gases than other forms of animal protein. For cellular agriculture, the environmental impact varied substantially. Some products performed better and others worse than all other animal products except beef. So why is there such a large range? Part of the answer is that we don't have very good data yet. Rachel Santo and her co-authors looked at all of the studies available at the time, which for cellular agriculture were very few. On the positive side for alternatives, you don't have to grow animal feed, which has lots of land, water, and carbon emissions associated with that production. On the other hand,
the substantial processing footprint associated with cell-based production might limit some of their potential benefits compared to other farmed meats.
The studies showed a range of possible emissions from each cellular-based production system, and this came from having different assumptions about
the processing side of producing cell-based meat, so the facility size, the potential density, the proliferation of cells.
Rachel Santo acknowledges there's an opportunity to reduce emissions through scaling these operations, so studies in the future might show different results. Think about the cost of solar panels now compared to 10 years ago, or even the efficiency of poultry production compared to the past. When we consider the fact that most of the greenhouse gas emissions from cellular agriculture come from the energy required to run the bioreactors, even when countries shift to renewable energy, which should be an urgent priority, that would dramatically cut down the emission profile of cellular meat. So there are absolutely room for efficiency improvements over time. But one important note here, there are some technical challenges around scaling cellular agriculture that the industry has not yet found a solution for.
In terms of animal welfare, a big variable in the case of cell-based meats is that fetal bovine serum, or more accurately, finding a replacement for it, is one of the biggest remaining challenges in the industry.
So fetal bovine serum is an important growth supplement that's used in cell and tissue culture medium. It's not just used in this industry, but also in drug and vaccine production.
And it comes from the blood of a live cow fetus after the mother is slaughtered for meat processing. So fetal bovine serum is a byproduct of the meat industry. It's not something that animals are raised and slaughtered for solely for its production. But since the overall goal of cell-based meat production is to be no-kill or to involve as few animals as possible, one of the critical pieces moving forward is to find a viable replacement for it.
Alternatives like serum-free growth medium do exist, and there's lots of ongoing research into bringing down the cost of these alternatives. Many companies are currently using fetal bovine serum in their trials, though not all of them. The company Upside Foods, who received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to begin producing cultivated meat for markets in the United States, are not using fetal bovine serum. And while animals do need to be slaughtered to produce this serum, it's worth acknowledging that the number pales in comparison to the estimated 80 billion land animals killed each year for meat. So that's a little on the environmental and ethical considerations. How about nutrition? Are these products healthy for you to eat?
Even though plant-based substitutes are made from legumes like soybeans and peas, which are quite nutritious and which may reduce individuals' risk for certain chronic diseases, we don't yet know whether these highly processed versions of legumes will offer similar benefits as if you were to eat the whole legumes directly.
In the case of cellular agriculture, companies aren't only trying to mimic the taste and texture, but also the nutritional profile of meat.
Some researchers have speculated that you could tweak the nutritional profile of cell-based meats to be healthier, but we haven't yet seen evidence of that.
So the health impacts of eating these products aren't clear at this point. It's not as clear as the health benefits of eating meat or eating whole plant-based foods like legumes, whole grains, vegetables, and nuts, or even processed soy like tofu. This research is especially hard to do since every company has a different process, so it's hard to generalize the benefits and it's hard to scrutinize every individual company's claims.
The main message I like to emphasize is that it's urgent that we reduce our meat and dairy consumption, particularly in high-income countries, to avoid the most catastrophic climate change scenarios.
In summary, Rachel Santo of the Center for a Livable Future isn't so sure that meat alternatives are the silver bullet solution to problems with the food system, but hopes that we can continue to have nuanced and critical discussions around the potential benefits and limitations of these alternatives. To examine another important question, will people eat these products? We look at some recent trends.
4 or 5 years ago, we started to see the emergence of products that really brought a lot of food science to bear to try to mimic the taste of traditional, mainly beef products, even though there are other products out there now.
Jason Lusk, agricultural economist at Purdue University, who joined us for the Efficient Meat episode, is actually quite hopeful about the development of these products.
And for a while, those experienced some pretty significant market share growth. So if you start from, say, 2018 to 2020, pretty astounding increases in sales of those emerging products.
They started from a small base, but
there were some astronomical percentage growth, you know, 50%, 100% growth. I don't know that the pandemic caused it, but about the time of the pandemic came in, we started to see growth in many of those product categories start to slow.
In the last 2 years, the big growth that Jason was just describing has started to either plateau or even decline. Part of what these companies are betting on is that they can cater to meat eaters and not only vegetarians. And are they right to think that?
You know, a lot of the people who tried the plant-based meat alternatives also bought meat. So on the one hand, you might think that that's good for the plant-based meat alternatives because they're crossing over, pulling traditional meat eaters into this category, which is a much bigger group, of course, than just vegetarians. So that is true. We see that in our data. At the same time, though, you can also see that the people buying the plant-based alternatives in general bought a lot less meat.
So it seems that more vegetarians are buying these products, but they're not the only ones. The question remains if people will actually replace more of the meat in their diets with these meat alternatives. Some evidence shows it was the novelty factor that drove the initial growth. People were excited to try something new, but they didn't keep buying it. Other data shows it seems to be more popular with the younger generation. So that could be a bright spot for these companies in the future. But with the global pandemic and cost of living crisis, it's not surprising that people aren't running to eat these new products, especially when some cost more than meat. Jason Lusk raises one more consideration, which is the quote, unnaturalness of these products.
I see it discussed a lot on social media and those sorts of things, and that is the emergence of the plant-based meat alternatives is running up against another trend, which is this move towards quote-unquote clean products, unprocessed products with fewer numbers of ingredients.
So will people prefer the real thing rather than the alternative? Despite some big recent headlines saying that meat alternatives are overhyped, it's genuinely way too early to tell. I see three possible futures here. One, alternatives have already hit their peak, which doesn't bode well for the future. Two, we could see small changes that continue to bring down the price and improve taste to convert people more slowly over time. Or three, a technological breakthrough around scaling cellular agriculture could be a game changer. Part 5. Different roads to a 2050 alternative meat future. When we talk about the future, we need to talk about at least three different categories for alternative meat. There's plant-based meat substitutes and mycoprotein, like we talked about earlier. They're already here. You may have been eating them recently or for a long time, and the products are becoming more meat-like. Then there's cellular agriculture, or cultivated meat, which has more unknowns. But they all share the same goal, of partially or completely replacing industrial animal agriculture. So how do they plan to do that? There are a few different visions.
It was the first salmon I've had in probably close to 20 years, and I had it in sushi form, and it was incredible. I hope that doesn't sound like boosterism, but it was just like a wonderful culinary experience.
That's Jan Dukovic, policy fellow at Harvard Law, who recently tasted salmon from a company called Wildtype. Yes, they're also working to replicate fish. The product was a blend of plant-based ingredients and some grown from animal cells. It's safe to say he's excited about the future of cellular agriculture.
I think it's a technology that we should strive to develop, and that it is a good in and of itself, whether it's developed with public funding by the private sector or what have you. I also think it's very important to put a huge asterisk beside the technology, given that we don't know whether or not it's actually viable at scale.
We don't know if the science and engineering behind cellular agriculture will develop to outperform meat on price, on taste, and on quality. Part of what this technology looks like in 2050 depends on who's investing in it.
Most investment has come from venture capital. And on the one hand, that's great in the sense of there was nowhere else to get funding for this technology. It doesn't quite fit traditional funding models.
Universities and public funding did help develop the prototypes of these products, but venture capital is really getting it off the ground. Though Yad Dukovich has some concerns about the impact of that.
If there's a lot of venture capital invested in this space, then two things happen. Number one, IP, so intellectual property, becomes extremely important.
So the tendency to rely on intellectual property means that companies are more likely to be protective of their own technology and wish to develop their own patents, rather than work together to develop the sector as a whole. There are fundamental questions about infrastructure and lab protocol and safety that public funding could help resolve.
When you kind of privatize a field out of the gate, there's going to be a lot of redundancy.
Isha Dattar again, executive director of New Harvest, a research institute dedicated to advancing the science of cultured meat.
I can guarantee you that most of these companies are doing approximately the same thing or have done approximately the same thing for the first year or two of their lives. And that's just a waste of energy because they're not publishing, they're not sharing that knowledge, they don't have people kind of going around talking about it at conferences.
And besides intellectual property, Jan Dukovic sees another challenge.
Eventually, venture capital, no matter how quote-unquote ethical the investors are, eventually will want to see a return on investment.
Jan worries that these prototypes will be brought into the market too early in order to grow their business. And there's a strong incentive to do that. It's an important way to attract more investment. Jan Dukovic and Isha Dattar were two co-authors of a recent article that shares its concerns about racing to put these products on shelves. They worry that moving too quickly might come at the expense of what's motivating this group in the first place.
Which is ultimately to displace conventional meat with a product that beats conventional meat on all metrics, a product that is more sustainable, a product that does not use animal products, a product that is healthy and economically viable at scale.
There's been around $2 billion of private investment into the sector. The NGO New Harvest recently got $10 million from the United States Department of Agriculture. But if Isha Dattar had $2 billion...
I would have put at least $1 billion just into the fundamental research, make sure that there are kind of the building blocks of the field are publicly available and open, and then give the other $1 billion to the companies who are taking those building blocks and then turning it into something, adding their special sauce and turning that into products.
So yeah, so I think the technology's getting there, at least when it comes to flavor and texture with some products. But now the real big question is scaling and being able to make this a viable business. And I think this is where, in part, public funding can help.
So both Isha Dattar and Jan Dukovic see public funding as foundational to scaling. Paul Shapiro of the Better Meat Co. is following another trend in the industry.
The largest meat company on the planet, it's called JBS, it's from Brazil, just announced a $100 million investment into what's called cultivated meat. Tyson Foods, Cargill, these are companies that are all investing in this space right now.
Paul looks at this and thinks,
I want to solve this problem. The problem is that we're raising billions of animals for food. And so I want to do whatever it takes. Like, we are in an environmental crisis. The ship is going down. And so if scaling and concentration end up getting this problem solved quicker, meaning that you can have lower prices, which is what you really ultimately need in order to compete, then I'm for it. It's not that I have some philosophical preference for it. I don't. I would rather see a decentralized economy. That would be great. But the problems are too dire and too urgent to let that be the big concern that would prevent us from moving toward this future.
Paul Shapiro wants a paradigm shift to change how we think about meat.
In the past, meat has basically meant a hunk of flesh from a once living animal's body. Now, people are starting to think about meat in a far more diverse way, where we're thinking about meat coming from plants, coming from animal cells, coming from microbial fermentation, and more.
Paul Shapiro and others want to think of animal slaughter for meat as a thing of the past, an outdated technology. And he invites any combination of ways to get there, to bring humanity in that direction.
In the alternative protein world, where it may not be one thing, it may not be one technology, that ends up replacing the exploitation of chickens and pigs and cows and turkeys, but it's going to be a combination of them. And I think that in the same way that many of us would never dream of using a horse-drawn carriage to get around anywhere today, our descendants will never dream of locking animals up in cages and slaughtering them and so on. And they'll think, I'm so glad that innovators created better ways to feed ourselves, in the same way we are glad that people who innovated and created ways to get around that don't involve horses.
We can't feed the world with the technologies of the 1800s.
Steve Jurvetson again, venture capitalist who has been funding companies like Upside Foods and Better Meat Co., describes a potential decentralized vision.
So you could envision a future where meat is manufactured all over the planet, close to the point of consumption, that it's not being trucked around on trains, it's not going to major meat hubs, you're not doing slaughterhouses. There's all this element of complexity you don't need if you can make and consume all within a local area. In fact, a lot of the urban parking lots that are probably not going to be needed once we have fully autonomous cars and you don't need to park so much could be converted into meat manufacturing locations within city centers where a majority of people live.
He also sees a future where the company that can scale most efficiently can dominate the competition. For Steve Jurvetson, what will really launch the growth of these products is actually experiencing and tasting them.
And isn't it patently obvious that there's a better way in front of us? And maybe as a venture capitalist, I saw it before others because I actually toured these places, tasted their product. But once you've had a bite of the future, how can you deny its inevitability? And wouldn't you want in your life to say you helped make that happen?
Is this the future for meat and livestock that you're most excited about or most concerned about? If it sounds like the plot from a science fiction movie, how do you think it ends? Well, it's not a fantasy. You can find plant-based meat substitutes in markets and restaurants today, and possibly ones from animal cell cultures in the next few years or decades. I have so many questions still, but we'll need to be patient for some of the answers. On one hand, the first lab-grown burger in 2013 cost 250,000 euros. Now you can find it for less than 10 euros. And in big news for the industry, the company Upside Foods received approval in the US to begin producing cultivated meat. They joined the company Eat Just, who has been selling no-kill chicken in restaurants in Singapore since 2021. But it's not clear to me that cellular agriculture will be able to scale and be safely available on markets. And if it does, will it only end up as a high-end product in expensive restaurants? A pathway that really wouldn't put a dent into industrial animal production? Or will it be affordable for everyone in retail markets? And given the option, what would you choose? If it was at the same price and the same taste, would you eat a cut of meat from a lab rather than from a farm? Or maybe you wouldn't want anything meat or meat-like at the center of your plate at all. You can let us know what you think by recording your voice in a quiet room and sending it to podcast@tabledebates.org, and we might include your thoughts in a future episode. Thanks to everyone that's written and called in so far, and please continue to do so. There are many companies that we could have spoken to for this episode. Some who are 3D printing meat, others who are trying to grow protein from just sunlight and nutrients. But one group we did speak to was those who are farming insects. Stay tuned for an upcoming episode where we look at a bug-based future as a possible sustainable food source. Next week, we'll visit the farms that some of the people in this future hope to put out of business. You'll hear farmers and researchers make the case that livestock shouldn't be thought of only as providing good nutrition, but also as having many other benefits, like managing ecosystems, reducing food waste, and converting land that isn't suited for crops into nutritious meat and milk.
I can't see how I can produce cereals in a good way if I don't have the cattle in the crop rotation.
We know we cannot eat this much meat. we can eat better meat, but regardless, we need to eat less meat.
Thanks to you for listening. If you like this episode, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It really helps us spread the word about the show. And a big thanks to all the voices you heard on this episode. And if you want to see the mural that Paul Shapiro was describing, you can visit our website, tabledebates.org/meet. Meet the Four Futures is funded by Formis in Sweden, initiated by the Future Food Platform, and produced by Table, a collaboration between the University of Oxford, Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, and Vageryd University. This episode was edited and mixed by Matthew Kessler and Ilva Karkvist-Varnborg, and a huge team of support. Special shout out to Tansen Blackster for all your script notes on this episode. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and Epidemic Sound. Talk to you next week in the Less Beat Future.